So educators, we get this powerful role of importance in many of their lives, and we don't even know it. So what we say matters to these kids. So I wanted to go through 10 examples of places where we could potentially be a threat to our kids. And I'm going to run through these pretty quickly. And I want you to think about your teaching and how you show up, or examples of things you've done.
Welcome to the Society's Child podcast, where we have real conversations about being a trauma-responsive educator in the midst of a significant mental health crisis. Hi, I'm Trish Senzek, a former educator, compassion advocate, and Jesus lover, and I'm so grateful that you're here. Are you feeling confuzzled about your students' behavior and needs? You're not alone. If trauma-informed strategies leave you wondering, what's next? Don't worry. My friend, I've been there too. As a foster mom and a child of complex trauma mixed with my experience as a teacher, it's led me to finding a compassionate, whole child approach that's evidence-based, practical, and transformational, and I'm so eager to share it with you. Whether you want to connect with your students on a deeper level, create a trauma-sensitive environment, or you just need a little bit of encouragement or support, you're in the right place. So grab a drink, a pen, or your earbuds, and let's work together to create a safe and student-attuned, trauma-responsive school culture. Society's children need you. So let's get started.
When I was in college, I had a statistics professor that I swore hated me. I'd never met the man, and I dreaded his class. He made any of us that didn't get statistics or didn't like the class feel really stupid and ill-equipped. He'd even often make very intimidating comments to the whole class, and it portrayed his extremely high expectations and unwavering attitude about how he felt about his content. I was not a math student. I was more of a writer and a communications person, but I only took that class because it was actually something that was required. I struggled in that class, and even one time found myself intimidated because I had to go to his office and discuss my grade with him. That was a miserable failure. I was met with his extreme disgust, his impatience, his dismissiveness, and any question I tried to ask, it was totally just disregarded. In the last few weeks, we've had some great leaders on this podcast, and if you haven't had a chance to listen, I encourage you to go back and listen, because a lot of that is leading up to today. Today's episode, we're going to look inward and ask ourselves a very difficult question. Could I be a threat to my students? Now, before we do that, I want to remind you, I have a personal Facebook group that I welcome educators into. If you're a Christian educator, no matter where you're teaching, I want to invite you to come on into the group. It is called Society's Child Create a Trauma-Responsive Educational Setting, and it has podcast in the parentheses. So come on into that group. I would love to be able to love on you a little bit and encourage you. I put up daily affirmations in there, and I just want you to know you're welcome to continue these conversations in that group. When I think back on this particular professor, I wanted to bring this up because he wasn't necessarily threatening me in a physical sense to where I felt endangered by him physically by any means. But when I went into teaching, I really took some of these traits that were done to me and brought them into teaching because that was how I thought it needed to be. I thought I needed to be powerful. I thought I needed to be indomitable and just downright rigid. And I wish I'd known then what I know now. I wish I'd known about trauma, my own included, and the damage that I could be inflicting by being a tyrant at times, if you will. So my rigidity at times, I'm sure, caused some of my students some internal pain. Now, I've since learned a lot about trauma and my own growing and my own behaviors, and I've really come to sense with this, and I try to make amends whenever I can. But I've learned that many times our kids, especially since we're looking at the rates of depression and suicide and anxiety in our world, these kids must be affected by what we're saying to them and the kinds of things that we're portraying in our classes. And some of these kids might be considering me or did consider me as a threat. Now, it doesn't, again, mean that I'm intentionally trying to physically hurt them. Not by a long shot. In fact, my heart, it was never my intention to hurt anyone. In fact, if I would go back to some of these situations and look back at them, I would probably be very upset with myself for how I was acting. My heart was soft for my students, but my words and actions sometimes were very hard. So many of my students could have perceived me as a threat. So what do I mean by perceived threat? Well, it could be any situation, any stimuli of with students that they could potentially perceive as harmful, whether it's physically, and that's not what we're talking about here, but emotionally and psychologically. That emotional and psychological piece is the part that I really want to talk about because we can't see it. And it really does have a significant impact on our students' ability to engage in learning. So let's talk about what I mean by that. So there's a lot of types of things that our kids are already walking around with. They have a lot of insecurities, more than we can even see, more than we know is already there. For example, many of our kids walk around with the fear of failure, the fear of judgment or being ridiculed, the fear of discrimination or bias, or fear of being punished or having to put up with unnecessary consequences, the fear of not being good enough or not being important, not being included, not fitting in. Here's one: being out of control or being wrong or being the center of attention. It could be any one of these. It could be a mixture of these. But this is magnified in kids with trauma. It's magnified with kids who are neurodivergent learners and special needs. And it's magnified for kids who are marginalized in society, either socially or even culturally. Heck, I think many of us listening to this probably have one, two, or more on that list that we even walk around with. So with that idea in mind, we need to consider of how we show up in our classes and the strategies that we use to, open quote, empower our kids, close quote. I think that we think we're doing great for them by being in this mode, but sometimes I think it's doing more damage. We know that children and adolescents up to about age 18, they're more self-focused. So they're navigating their identity, trying to create and form their own formation of who they are through what's being said to them and through their social interactions. They're picking up on messages that we deliver to them, and they're also filtering their truth by what's said to them. So educators, we get this powerful role of importance in many of their lives, and we don't even know it. So what we say matters to these kids. So I wanted to go through 10 examples of places where we could potentially be a threat to our kids. And I'm going to run through these pretty quickly, and I want you to think about your teaching and how you show up or examples of things you've done. And this is not meant to pick or poke at somebody. It's literally just a way of self-examination. So if it is a behavior, it is a tactic that you use and you think it's doing good, I just want to encourage you to just become aware of it and accept, okay, this could potentially be harmful to kids and the way they think or feel. And I want to try to just come to that place of acceptance of, okay, I know that I can change this behavior, and I know that I can, for the trauma-informed movement's sake, I can work on trying to adjust this a little bit. So number one is public criticism. Do you criticize students' work or behavior in front of the class? Maybe not intentionally embarrassing them or humiliating them, but ultimately to try to get them to, you know, do a little better and maybe shame them a little bit. So I want to encourage you, instead of that, use feedback that is done privately or constructively to avoid any kind of public harassment, because a lot of times these kids are comparing themselves to other people. Number two, do you use sarcasm or mockery to address students' mistakes? Holding up papers in front of the classroom, pointing out the ones that got the low grades, or maybe not overtly pointing them out, but saying, we had two F's in class today. And then when the kid gets their paper back, it's them. And it can belittle their efforts and discourage their participation or even speaking up. And they would want to hide and be shameful about that. So on the other hand, I would encourage educators to really remain respectful and supportive in all of your tone of voice, so that when you're providing this kind of feedback and addressing these errors, it doesn't feel shameful. It doesn't feel biting or hurtful if they receive a paper back or the sarcasm was pointed at them or if they felt mocked. Number three, speaking of comparing ourselves to others, students do this all the time. But are you comparing your students or their peers, whether explicitly or implicitly, and basically creating feelings of inadequacy from one person to another? And this could be in simple conversations of, oh, I had your brother, you should be more like your sister, or something along those lines, because each student has their own strengths and their own challenges. And many times they can't live into the shadow of another student. Maybe they want to be like that, but it's just not able, they're just not able to do it for whatever's going on for them. So it's essential that we as educators celebrate individual progress rather than fostering some competition or comparison to other kids in the room. Every kid is on a journey. Whether they fail, that's a learning unique opportunity. Or whether they're doing straight A's, every child is on their unique journey. So number four, are you labeling or stereotyping your kids? So making assumptions about a student based on stereotypes or preconceived notions, it can undermine their sense of identity or their self-worth. And many times we don't realize that we might put them in a certain class, and not as an educated classroom sitting in front of us, but in a certain area or in a certain way of speaking to them, and we're labeling them as a certain type of child, and they pick up on this. So we should be really mindful of the language that we use and avoid labeling students in ways that reinforce any negative stereotypes or any negative biases that they may already know about themselves. We just don't need to point them out. Number five, are you ignoring or dismissing any contributions the student is making in your class? So being disregarding or dismissing some sort of contribution the kid makes, they may have a certain level of pride about that. So whether it's in class discussions or group activities, is there a way that's happening that they're being dismissed or made to feel unimportant or invisible, maybe talked over? I would encourage you to actively listen to all students and validate their perspectives, whether it's a valid contribution or not. Yes, sometimes the students are being goofy or they're saying things out loud. We don't want to, of course, recognize behavior like that, but there are softer ways to put that aside so that we're not ignoring them in a way that, or dismissing them that's a ding to their fear of being invisible or not being important enough to speak up. Sometimes it takes a lot for these kids to actually speak up. Number six, are you overemphasizing grades or performance? Placing excessive emphasis on grades or academic performance, it can create a high-pressure environment where students feel judged just solely on their based on their achievements. A lot of our students that are coming into our classrooms, they're struggling readers, they're struggling learners, and many of them can't meet up to the straight-A kid or the one that's doing the best or the stellar kid. They just feel like they would never be adequate enough to do that. Instead, I want to encourage educators to focus on the growth mindset and emphasizing the value of effort and progress and learning and really appreciating the effort that they put in and how hard a student worked, instead of emphasizing the academics, overemphasizing the grades and overemphasizing the performance. Number seven, this one is a little harder. Do you have body language or nonverbal clues that might be distressing to a student? So for example, nonverbal clues such as eye rolling, sighing, facial expressions of disapproval or disdain towards a particular student without saying a word, but the message is clear in the body language. I'm guilty of this one. I've done it. I've rolled my eyes. I've made comments to kids without saying a particular word. My look can mean a lot. So I want to encourage educators to be mindful of our body language and just really strive to maintain a supportive, approachable demeanor with all kids. And I know this is tough when we have conflicts with kids and we have a hard time being able to work with kids and really get along. There are always going to be kids that get on our nerves, but we have to really work on being equal and non-judgmental in that way with our body language. Number eight. Do you have unrealistic expectations? and setting unattainable expectations for students that can create feelings of failure or inadequacy. I did this a lot. I regret doing this because I would set these high, high goals and expected every kid, no matter what their situation was, no exceptions. And I made it known that there were no exceptions. I know this is something we do as educators because we think we want our kids to strive to that point. But especially for our trauma kids or our kids who are neurodivergent learners or kids who are just insecure in general, we have to understand that it's essential for educators to really set goals that are challenging but achievable. So in other words, if I come into the class, which I've been known to say, very few kids get A's in my class, and I'm proud of that fact, that basically sets an unattainable goal. So we really want our goals to be achievable, and then we want to provide support and encouragement along the way so that everybody can attain that if they truly want to. Number 9, and this one's a big one, especially in the trauma-informed world, are we ignoring emotional needs? So many times, especially for those of us who've come from places where we have little tolerance for ailments or what we would perceive someone as being weak, we sometimes perceive emotions as being a weak thing that is going on with our kids. So we might disregard or minimize any student's emotional needs. That can send a message that their feelings aren't valid or they're not important. And so that's a threat to their security of being able to stand in and be okay with expressing their emotions. Because most of us grew up in a world where we disregarded our emotions. And so we're kind of used to doing that sort of thing. So I would encourage educators to basically create a safe and supportive environment where students can be comfortable expressing their emotions and seek help when they need it. Number 10, and this one is something that I think is big across our world, is, are you being culturally insensitive? So having an insensitivity about a student's cultural background, their experiences or identities, or a group of people or the type of group that they live in, it can lead to feelings of alienation. It can lead to feelings of being shamed and as if they're afraid to admit where they are actually coming from or what group they're part of. I would encourage educators to really strive to be culturally responsive in your classroom. Create an environment that's rich with cultural information, celebrates diversity, and promotes that inclusivity. And I think we're doing better about this and trying to, but there's still so much strife over the cultural wars that are going on that I think sometimes we bring our own biases into the classroom, and it's truly unfair to these kids. There are 10 things that you could be, and I'm sure there's more, that you could be doing that might make a student feel threatened or have a perceived threat from you. So why is this important? Well, understanding this impact is super important because I want you to understand that it can have detrimental effects and that these perceived threats can really harm a student's academic success and their well-being. I want to encourage you to understand kids. Because when they feel threatened, any cognitive resources that we're putting into the learning, it's diverted away from that. They go into negative self-talk. They go into distracted worry, their inability to focus. Then all of a sudden they're spinning and their thoughts are out of control. And then later on, they might even spin on that thought or bring something to the attention of like, they embarrassed me. I don't know what to think about it. And it consumes their thoughts. Basically, it leads to decreased motivation to learn, decreased motivation to perform or perform for you or perform for themselves. It also can impair memory retention because they're distracted and not able to retain things because they're off thinking and spinning on these thoughts. And then therefore, they can have a difficulty concentrating and getting through the lesson or even remembering what was said in class. So this is very important information to learn. So what can we do about this? Well, I've got 3 suggestions that I would strongly recommend. Number 1, just looking at the trauma-informed movement in itself. There are a couple things, there's lots you can do with becoming trauma-informed, but number 1 is creating that safe learning environment so that all kids are equally respected no matter how much you care or don't care about them. It would be super important to really be thinking about how am I creating a safe learning environment? And then how am I building trust? And how am I empowering these students to be resilient through the self-regulation techniques, through positive mindset, self-advocating for themselves, and really just kind of teaching them of what kind of teaching is healthy and what's not. If we can do this, then we would be also supporting the social emotional learning, not only just what we're doing in our class, but also what the school is bringing to us. And we would be able to support it not only with what we're doing in our classes, but what the school-wide culture is doing and wherever it's being brought into the onto our campuses. Number two, I would encourage you to avoid assumptions. So many times we make assumptions by looking at kids. This is just a human natural nature thing. And we have these beliefs that we're brought up with. And so I'm going to ask you to consider if this is you unlearning some things that you're already just making assumptions about with kids. For example, one of the things that I think is a biggie one for me is everybody can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Everybody can suck it up and learn. And everybody can overcome adversity through sheer willpower and sheer determination. I'm guilty of that. But what this does is this kind of forgets or disregards what kids are going through. It disregards any inequalities that kids have. So they're building up their stereotypes based on how they're being treated and the inequalities that are happening. It's disregarding anyone that might have no access to resources or opportunities that they need to succeed. What if they're not getting those resilience building techniques outside of your classroom? What if they're not getting that? They may not have the skills to just pull up their bootstraps and move on. So I would encourage you, that's the first assumption that I would encourage you to kind of let go of a little bit. It doesn't mean that it can't be learned, but it's something that we cannot assume that everyone has that ability. Another one that I'll just say quickly is effort equals success. There's a widespread belief that success is directly proportional to how much effort we put in. While effort is undoubtedly important, we all know that. It's not the only factor that influences success. And many of our kids who've been through trauma, they're at a major disadvantage. And external factors, of course, the resources, the systemic barriers and things like that, and luck, and you know, we can talk about all of that with meaning that might be in their way. But also, I just want to remind you that kids who've been through trauma, they have a longer road to go. So they can put in all the effort they want to in grades 1 through 12 or K through 12. And then when they get to college, you think, oh yeah, anybody can go to college. But many of these kids are emotionally behind and therefore educationally behind. And they may go on to college, but they're not mentally or emotionally ready or prepared to do that. So all the effort in the world may look like great effort, but they're still not successful in those terms. And so they may have to go around the block to get there, and they may have to work it a different way. But it's not always about effort. Sometimes it's outside tools and other things that will help them. And the last thing I'm going to encourage you to do, and this one's even harder, is to take yourself outside of yourself and imagine, what is it like on the other side of me? This is really a powerful empathy building exercise for educators because we can gain valuable insights into the experiences and challenges and needs from the other side of your classroom. And if you were looking at yourself in the way that you're looking at your students, how would it be received? If you said that to you at that age, what would it feel like? With that tone of voice, did it feel sharp or cutting? Did it feel sarcastic or did it feel threatening in any way? These perspectives are super important because it'll also help you in this to really identify the barriers that you're putting up to your students' learning. It'll help you adapt your teaching. So if you can imagine what it's like for your students on the other side of you and receiving you, and if there's anything you could tweak, what would it be? So I pray that you have the courage to look inward. And if you're using any of these 10 things or anything else that you could think of while I was talking about how you think you're empowering your kids, I pray that you will find some time to really get some discernment, get some quiet time, and work on becoming aware of where it's hurting our kids. And really think about how you can remove these tactics from your classroom, from your way of teaching. Learn more about speaking life over these kids. You have a strength that you can offer these kids. You are in a powerful position to be able to help form some identities, not just in their social interactions in the classroom, but if you're saying something to these kids in the classroom in front of everybody else, you're forming their social peers and you're forming thoughts and you're forming things about them in interactions. And it is crucial that we are careful in how we're addressing these kids. So I want to encourage you to do some self-discovery and some healing so that you can get to a place of ownership on how you're showing up and that you can make some improvement to help these kids. Because after all, it's all about the kids. When I first went into teaching, these traits that I carried into the classroom with me, they didn't serve me. And I know in my heart now, in hindsight, that I've been a threat to many of my students. Yes, it could have been a perceived threat, but I know I dinged some hearts, and it just pains my soul to think about it. Yes, I work very hard on kind of overcoming this thought process. I didn't need to be powerful. I didn't need to be indomitable. I didn't need to be just downright rigid. And there were times that I was. But I've learned in my recovery, and I've learned in my new trauma-informed movement learnings that I do even with my parenting, that it's important to make amends. And this concept of rupture and repair, if you ever feel like, even right now, if you've got a student sitting in front of you that you may have harmed, I encourage you to be the bigger person. Because if you've ruptured that relationship, you have the moral obligation to go repair it. And working to repair that relationship may speak volumes, and it may teach a big life lesson to that student that they will forever hold on to. We know too much now in this social emotional learning world and in this trauma informed world, and it's time for educators to make a change. It's time for us to not only just become trauma informed, we must become trauma responsive. We've got to learn how to adapt our behavior in the classroom so that we are responding to these kids with unconditional love and building them up in a way that is powerful. So I pray that this has been helpful. I hope that you found something that you can take away. Please share this podcast with your friends and other educators, because the only way that this gets out is if you will click that like, or actually the follow button on this podcast, and subscribe to the show, and then share it with your educator friends. It would mean the world to me, and it would help more campuses become trauma responsive. And that's my heart. Let's rally together, my friends. Until next time. Hey, amazing educators. Thanks for tuning in. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love for you to hit subscribe and leave a review. Even better, share this episode with a colleague. And hey, I'd love to connect with you on social media. You can even join my Facebook group for some extra support and a dash of inspiration. I've left all the links in the show notes. Until next time, my friend, remember, you're not alone on this journey. You've got this. Keep making a difference and stay teach-tastic.